This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, whatever else you know about the Underground Railroad, you understand that it wasn't an actual railroad. But in his new novel, Colson Whitehead imagines a literal Underground Railroad for slaves. He tells the story of an enslaved woman who flees a Georgia plantation in the mid-1800s using an underground system of tracks and trains with engineers and conductors. The book is called The Underground Railroad. Colson Whitehead reads Thursday at the Durham Armory and is with us today on The State of Things. Colson, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Hey, howdy. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. What inspired the use of a literal underground railroad for this novel?
Yeah, it's sort of a fanciful idea, I guess. About 16 years ago, I was laying on my couch and came across a reference to the railroad and remembered how as a kid, when I was in fourth or fifth grade, when I first heard those words, Underground Railroad, I envisioned a literal subway beneath the earth. And then, of course, you find out a few minutes later that that's not how it works. It's not really possible to pull off. But I thought, you know, that would be a cool premise for a book. And I kept thinking, how else can we complicate it? And so I thought, what if every state our protagonist goes through as he or she moves north, South Carolina, North Carolina, is a different state of American history, a sort of alternative America. And then that's a story right there.
Yeah, and so there's that element of magical realism that runs through it. Cora, our protagonist, is the constant in all of this. And in that way, it's a kind of coming-of-age story as well, because this is a young woman who's traveling through American history underground and who is also sort of at the most interesting point in her life as a woman.
Well, yeah, I mean, she starts off as an object, a piece of property with no agency. And as she moves north and has these different escapades in these different states, she becomes more of a person. She understands herself and the world bit by bit. Every mile she goes north, becoming more of a whole person and not an object anymore.
And understands the institution of slavery, as she is an enslaved woman herself or begins that way, and yet, you know, not necessarily understanding the entire history until she comes to North Carolina. Describe that for us.
Well, yeah, well, you know, for many years I had different characters and cultures for these different states, and South Carolina is a seemingly benevolent state where freed slaves are given housing and jobs and education. And then North Carolina is a white supremacist state modeled after Nazi Germany or Oregon, which was founded as a white separatist state in the 1800s. And there, black people are outlawed. You know, they've solved the question of slavery by making it illegal to be African American in that state. And if you're caught, you can be lynched. They have weekly lynchings accompanied by minstrel shows and music, and it's a sort of grim pageant that each town has every Friday.
She and part of that pageantry is the museum where she sort of enacts the life of a slave.
Yeah, I'm trying to give my character opportunities to grow and understand the world and herself. You know, I'm always trying to think of different situations. And so in South Carolina, she becomes part of a museum exhibit where she pretends to be a slave, an African in an African village, a person on a slave ship, and a worker on a plantation. And of course, it's very sanitized. And so when she's in the slave ship display, she's working on deck as a sort of assistant and not chained in the hold. When she works in a plantation in the plantation diorama, she's spinning clothes and not doing, you know, backbreaking work in the fields. And so, you know, I'm trying to comment on how we sanitize history in order to make it palatable.
It's interesting, though, in this same instance where she's in a white supremacist institution that is dominating the narrative by using this museum, she does grow in consciousness. She begins to understand an institution, even though it's an attempt by certainly the white owners to tell the story their own way.
Sure. Well, you know, she's uneducated. You know, before she runs off the plantation, she can't read. She has no idea of what the world is outside the property line. And so, you know, hopefully in every interaction, she's, you know, become having a greater idea of the world and what slavery means. There are big plantations. You can be a slave in a house slave in a brownstone in a Baltimore. You can be one of two slaves on a small family farm. And so, you know, in doing my research, you know, I think there's a pop culture idea of like the southern, the deep south plantation with 100 slaves. But there's such a huge variety of the slave experience in the 1700s, 1800s, and then in the 1850s when the cotton boom has sort of taken over the country's economic engine.
Tell me more about your research. How big a part did slave narratives play in your research?
That was a big part. You know, there was one history called Bound for Canaan, and that's a history of the Underground Railroad that was helpful and introduced me to the real workings of the actual railroad. And then I went to the slave narratives, the famous ones by Frederick Douglass, Harriet Jacobs. Harriet Jacobs was in North Carolina, ran away from her master and hid in an attic for 7 years in a kind of Anne Frank situation, and that inspired Cora's adventures in North Carolina. And then in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, FDR, trying to get people back to work, started the WPA and hired writers to interview former slaves, people who were kids and teenagers at the time of the Civil War and still alive in the 1930s. And some of the interviews are two paragraphs long. Some are 2 pages. Some are 10 pages. And you get a real feel. I mean, a lot of the details in the early part of the book, of my book, are drawn from you know, the small details of the former slave's life that are in the narratives.
In that way, you do not blink when it comes to reflecting the brutality that is slavery.
No, I mean, you know, I use satire a lot in my work. And I felt, as I did more research, that kind of distancing technique wouldn't work for this. I don't know where my great-great-great-great-grandparents toiled. Were they in Florida or Georgia or North Carolina? Their histories disappeared into the black hole of slavery. And in order just to pay tribute to them and the other slave dead, I wanted to play it straight. And that means taking an unflinching look at the daily brutality of the slave system.
And yet I'm told that you tried to watch the movie 12 Years a Slave and frankly couldn't get through it all.
Yeah, you know, like when you start a work, sometimes you want to see what other people have done. Sometimes you want to stay away. Before I started writing, I was like, oh, I'll revisit Toni Morrison's Beloved and Edward Jones's The Known World just to see how they tackled it. And I got 30 pages into Beloved when I realized that I was just totally screwed. You can't really beat Toni Morrison. So I just have to do my own thing. And then in terms of the movie, I just put it off. And then I wrote 100 pages and decided, okay, now I can read it. I'm not going to become infected with, you know, someone else's vision. And it was just too horrifying. In my daily writing, I had a certain distance in order to shape the material and had a distance from the brutality of what I was describing. But seeing actual actors, human beings, enacting what I was putting on the page was too upsetting, and I had to turn the movie off after an hour.
I wonder if I could get you to read a section of your book for us, Colson.
Sure. This is towards the early part of the book. And in order to let off steam, there's a slave on the plantation named Old Jockey who decides once or twice a year that it's his birthday, and they have a celebration, food, and music. And it awakens them to the life force. You know, their daily lives are horrible, but if they can have a celebration once or twice a year, it takes a little bit of the edge off. So here they're having Jockey's birthday, and they're dancing. The music stopped. The circle broke. Sometimes a slave will be lost in a brief eddy of liberation, in the sway of a sudden reverie among the furrows, or while untangling the mysteries of an early morning dream, in the middle of a song on a warm Sunday night. Then it comes, always, the overseer's cry, the call to work, the shadow of the master, the reminder that she's only a human being for a tiny moment across the eternity of her servitude. The music stopped. The Randall brothers had emerged from the big house and were among them.
Colson Whitehead reading from his latest novel, The Underground Railroad. He'll be reading Thursday at 7 at the Durham Armory with us now on The State of Things. Cora has an interesting life, and I'm wondering how you brought her to life as a real person, as a kind of a three-dimensional character, because she's reluctant at first to run away. She does, but her mother ran away, which it struck me immediately is that this, on the one hand, gives you some sort of model for freedom. On the other hand, it leaves her with issues of abandonment quite clearly.
Sure. I mean, you know, I'm trying to create the psychology of Cora and the other people of the plantation, you know, I drew from my own observations about human behavior. And so, you know, we have a notion of PTSD in the culture now. These people were not post anything. They were enduring this trauma every minute of their lives. And it seemed on a 100-person plantation like the one in my book, you know, five people are great, five people are terrible, and most people are in the middle and vacillate between goodness and badness. But it seems if you've been so brutalized, you know, no one is on their best behavior. They're all just trying to survive and fighting for whatever they can have. And so when Cora's mother leaves, she's trying to save herself. Her name is Mabel, and she's been born to the system and has an opportunity to light out. And she goes and leaves her daughter. And that seems – it's terrible, but it also seems like a human response when sometimes you have no choice but to make that break and preserve oneself. Of course, it has – terrible ramifications for Cora being left alone astray on the plantation.
Eventually, she is recruited by a man named Caesar to escape using this literal underground railroad that you create. Tell us about Caesar and sort of what he represents for Cora.
Caesar is opportunity. He grew up on a small family farm in Virginia and was always promised his whole life that when his master died, an old lady, he and his parents would be set free. And then his master's heir had different ideas and sells the family south. They're separated, and he ends up on a much more vicious and brutal plantation down in Georgia. And his master taught him how to read. He knows a gentler, although still horrible, form of slavery and will do anything to return back to Virginia. And he sees in Cora a kindred spirit, someone who can stand up to the challenge.
I wonder if I could ask you to read again, and maybe this section, because we've been talking about this literal railroad with tracks and engineers at all, maybe you could read a section that illustrates how this railroad runs.
Surely. It's the first time they're in the subway, and they're talking to the station master Lumbly. Cora and Caesar are underground. "Every state is different," Lumbly was saying. "Each one a state of possibility, with its own customs and way of doing things. Moving through them, you'll see the breadth of the country before you reach your final stop." At that, the bench rumbled. They hushed, and the rumbling became a sound. Lumbly led them to the edge of the platform. The thing arrived in its hulking strangeness. Caesar had seen trains in Virginia. Cora had only heard tell of the machines. It wasn't what she envisioned. The locomotive was black, an ungainly contraption led by the triangular snout of the cowcatcher, though there would be few animals where this engine was headed. The bulb of the smokestack was next, a soot-covered stalk. The main body consisted of a large black box topped by the engineer's cabin. Below that, pistons and large cylinders engaged in a relentless dance with the 10 wheels, two sets of small ones in front and three behind. The locomotive pulled a single car, a dilapidated boxcar missing numerous planks in its walls. The colored engineer waved back at them from his cabin, grinning toothlessly. "All aboard," he said.
Colson Whitehead reading from his new novel, The Underground Railroad. Colson's going to be at the Durham Armory Thursday at 7 o'clock. This idea of taking us not only through space but through time, it seems to me is an interesting frame. And I wonder, when I thought about the slave catchers and your descriptions there, these are people who are going to stop any black person and ask them for their papers simply because they are black. That's the marker, all we need. And I think about today and racial profiling and how that has become led to brutality on our streets. How much of that played into your consciousness as you were writing this book?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't set out to comment on today's society so directly, but the comparisons are inescapable. And so before there was a police force 200 years ago, there was a slave patrols, and they could go into any slave cabin or free black person's house and demand to see people's papers, search for runaway slaves. And if you're not where you're supposed to be, you could be beaten, put in jail, dragged back to your master. The penalty for running away during the high cotton days in Georgia and Florida was death. And so your master could put you to death for running away. And, the parallels between that and stop and frisk are pretty obvious. So I didn't have to push a lot of the parallels that, become apparent as you read the book.
No, but it's also interesting to think about what that means for a people who have been the object of this kind of brutality, the cultural and collective history that and memory that you bring to this, how those stops register within that community that may be far different from what the officers and what the dominant community, the way they might see things.
Sure. No, I mean, I've been asked a lot, were you inspired by Ferguson and Black Lives Matter? And, they did start one of our periodic conversations about race in this country. But the fact that we have a terrible police brutality problem in our country is not news to me. I was raised in New York City in the 80s when all too frequently you would, have a black person put in a chokehold. There are various what's going on in the country is not particularly new, even if we have these conversations once in a while brief conversations before we turn our attention to something else.
And get right back at it again, sadly. Let me ask you about your writing style. You are famous for coming up with novels that are wildly different from one another, from the institutionist to John Henry Day's institutionist. It takes us to a dystopian future. We've got zombies in Zone 1, and here we've got some magical realism in the Underground Railroad, and yet John Henry Day's talks about is a kind of exploration of folklore, at least a part of the novel. Are you deliberate in that? Are you going to say my next novel will be nothing like the next one, or is it just something that happens to you?
It happened. It sort of happened naturally, and now it seems to be my shtick, so I might as well stick with it. So, when I'm done with a story or a certain kind of narrator, I'm really sick of it. And so, my first book was a takeoff on detective novels and had. The narrator had a very sort of clipped, direct way of speaking, and the main character was very repressed. And so for John Henry Day's, I wanted to have a much more expansive voice and a lot of different that spoke in a lot of different registers. And so that became an antidote to the book before. And my last book was a nonfiction book about the World Series of Poker, a lot of jokes in it. And definitely The Underground Railroad is a 180 degrees from that. Very few jokes, and when they are, they're pretty grim ones.
Pretty grim. Well, what's next?
a book set in 1960s Harlem. So,
all right. Well, we'll get through this one and then look forward to the next one. Colson, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Colson Whitehead. The new novel is called The Underground Railroad. He's going to be reading Thursday, 7 o'clock at the Durham Armory. We've got all the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll preview a documentary that tells the story of black American athletes during the 1936 Olympics. Stay with us on The State of Things.